Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people yielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I'm someone who looks at a clinical result and tries to see the human story behind the numbers. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out here fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Today, we are diving into a brand new format for the podcast with an episode about current topics in science and justice. I actually had planned to film this on my birthday. I'm a couple days late, but, you know, I kind of took the day off. But it felt like the perfect milestone to stop, step back, and look at the actual state of the world right now. Forensic reality is shifting under our feet at an unbelievable pace. And we are seeing massive real-time collisions where cutting-edge technology is running headfirst into stubborn, entrenched justice system. Because these developments are happening on an almost daily basis, this isn't going to be a one-off. I'm launching this as an ongoing internal series on the podcast to keep a permanent watch on the science as it hits the wire. This means that we aren't digging through historical archives today. Everything in this episode is happening right now. We are tracking biological breakthroughs that allow us to pull stable records from completely degraded trace evidence. We're looking at the private, persistent tracking that just shattered a 40-year dead zone in the Texas killing fields. But we're also auditing the dark side of the modern landscape. The terrifying modern state where human institutions actively choose to ignore scientific realities to protect old courtroom narratives. So grab your lab coats, let's look at the state of the world, audit the ledger, and see exactly where science and justice stand today. In an ideal world, we like to view the legal system as a well-oiled machine built to find the truth. But if we're being honest, the actual course of justice in this country is routinely choked out by politics, broken budgets, and administrative backlogs. When the legal machinery stalls out like that, it doesn't just cause a delay. It completely rewrites the outcome of a case. This month, though, decades of relentless advocacy finally forced a massive nationwide structural shift to bring us a little closer to the ideal. As of May 4th, 2026, all 50 states, alongside Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico, have officially enacted comprehensive rape kit reform. This massive nationwide sweep marks the end of a years-long battle against systemic inertia. Mariska Hargitay, best known for the 27 years she has been advocating for victims on Law & Order Special Victims Unit, took that charge into the real world through her tireless work with the Joyful Heart Foundation. From a purely clinical perspective, a rape kit is a high-stakes, time-sensitive sample. Leaving this biological evidence unread and uncatalogued in a dark storage unit isn't just a bureaucratic backlog. It's a catastrophic betrayal and complete failure of human justice. Testing these kits is not an administrative chore. It's a direct intervention that strips away the protection of anonymity from serial violent offenders who have operated with impunity for decades. Yet, despite this massive legislative sweep, the historical ledger remains incredibly grim. An estimated 100,000 untested kits still remain lost or undiscovered in dark storage units across the United States. Passing a law across all 50 states is great. Unfortunately, it only changes the rules on paper. It doesn't automatically fund the necessary testing. When the state machinery stalls out due to exhausted municipal budgets or political apathy, the path to justice can be completely cut off. This is one area where private citizens are being forced to step in and fill the data gap themselves. On May 6, 2026, the family of Kaylee Goncalves officially launched the Murder Has a Name Foundation to confront this exact financial bottleneck. Kaylee was one of four University of Idaho students brutally murdered in an off-campus house back in November 2022. Throughout that high-profile investigation, her family faced a massive wall of law enforcement silence, administrative checkpoints, and bureaucratic friction as they fought for updates and structural accountability. The Murder Has a Name Foundation is the direct result of that trauma. It is another case of private citizens actively crowdsourcing the capital required for advanced forensic DNA testing because local, state, and municipal budgets have completely frozen or stalled out. When bureaucracy cuts off the funding or the interest in an investigation, the community is often forced to bypass the state roadblocks entirely to see justice done, if they can. People are raising money independently just to get cold case evidence out of storage and directly onto an analyst's bench. When justice becomes a luxury item that families have to independently finance, the system has fundamentally failed. It proves that the barrier to solving these crimes is rarely a limitation of modern science, but rather a decision of where to allocate resources. If a family doesn't have the public platform or the community backing to raise thousands of dollars, their evidence simply rots. This reliance on private funding exposes a deeply fractured reality. We have the technology to solve these crimes, but the ability to access it is heavily segregated by wealth, publicity, and zip code. This disparity leads us directly into one of the most severe data failures in modern American history: the ongoing crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. The National Day of Awareness for this crisis, observed on May 5th, was originally chosen to honor the birthday of Hannah Harris, a 21-year-old member of the Northern Cheyenne tribe who went missing in 2013. Just like many of the cases we discuss on this podcast, her family was met with complete law enforcement stonewalling and had to form their own physical search parties to find her body. This isn't just a failure of local policing. It's a profound and systemic failure of database integration and a massive structural glitch. If you look at the math, the National Crime Information Center has logged 5,712 reports of missing American Indian and Alaska Native women and girls in a single year. Yet out of those thousands of active profiles, the Department of Justice Federal Missing Persons Database, NAMIS, has only officially recorded 116 of them. That's only 2%. That is a terrifying statistical erasure. And the main cause is a jurisdictional nightmare. When an Indigenous person goes missing, the overlapping jurisdictions between tribal, federal, and state law enforcement often create a massive black hole. Nobody knows who has the authority to process the scene, run the data, or pull the forensic resources. This means the critical first hours of an investigation are completely lost to bureaucracy while the trail goes cold. This is the ultimate example of invisibility in the data. On some reservations, Native women are murdered at a rate 10 times the national average, yet 95% of these cases never receive mainstream media coverage. If you are deliberately left out of the database, the science can't speak for you. We need to do better. But the data is finding a voice in other areas. May 2026 marks the one-year anniversary of Authorm's Project 525, an aggressive systemic initiative to identify 525 children listed as Jane or John Doe's in the NAMIS system. The first five names have officially been reclaimed, including Jimmy Allen Dollison, who went missing from Kansas City in 1972, and was finally identified over 50 years later through advanced forensic genetic genealogy. Authorm has brought resolution to over 600 cold cases nationwide. This proves we are firmly in the no-hide era. Clearing unidentified remains and restoring names to John and Jane Doe's at a rate of one human being every few days. At the same time, states are starting to realize that they have to fund science to fix their history. Just last month, the Florida Attorney General's office announced a major statewide partnership, earmarking $600,000 explicitly for genealogy network data tracking to help chip away at their staggering backlog of over 21,000 unsolved murders. This is a massive financial course correction for a state that historically has served as a playground for bad forensics. When we look at Florida's historical forensic ledger, we find a heavy reliance on junk science like video height analysis. Technicians would actually use distorted fisheye security lenses to guess a suspect's height against a doorframe, completely ignoring things like lens curvature, distortion, or, you know, mathematical error margins. Or how about unverified dog scent lineups, which were historically used as a primary conviction anchors in court without a single shred of biological or chemical backing? We are finally moving away from visual parlor tricks and unverified metrics, but the remnants of these bad forensics are still actively destroying lives. The only way to dismantle that legacy of junk science is to replace it with unassailable data. Florida is finally taking a step in that direction. To understand how we can eventually dismantle that legacy of bad metrics, we have to look at the cutting-edge tools currently being developed on the research bench. This month, we are tracking major leaps in how we process and salvage degraded physical evidence, starting with high-level software models that strip the guesswork out of scene reconstruction. But to trust these new systems, we have to address the AI elephant in the room. By introducing artificial intelligence to the tech bench, we're introducing a highly controversial new species of data. If a proprietary algorithm performs its calculations inside a black box, hidden behind corporate non-disclosure agreements and trade secrets, we haven't actually returned to objective truth. We've just outsourced our institutional bias to a piece of software. Because at the end of the day, a defense attorney cannot cross-examine an AI on the witness stand. You cannot question its training data, its code, or its internal logic. To prevent this tech from becoming the next generation of unverified junk science, the forensic community is enforcing a strict boundary. These models must face rigorous, independent validation protocols before their outputs ever enter a courtroom ledger. The first major shift navigating this high-stakes boundary is the introduction of digital twins for alcohol metabolism. Released on May 6, 2026, a groundbreaking AI model creates a hyper-customized visual digital twin of a specific suspect to simulate their precise biological absorption and elimination curves over time. This allows investigators to mathematically audit a suspect's exact level of intoxication at the precise timestamp a crime occurred. It completely replaces the loose margins of error and generalized averages found in traditional retrograde back calculations, which have historically failed under rigorous scientific scrutiny. Moving from molecular tracking to structural analysis, we're also seeing the rollout of AI-enhanced skeletal mapping. This new forensic software digitally maps and reconstructs shattered bone fragments using automated geometric puzzle-solving algorithms. By calculating exactly how the fragments fit back together, investigators can determine the precise velocity, angle, and trajectory of a blunt force strike or a bullet path in a 3D space. Moving to physical chemistry, we are seeing major updates in how we pull trace data from materials previously considered forensically inert. Take the advancement of electrochemical fingerprinting on fired brass. The technical limit here has always been absolute. The massive thermal energy of a firearm discharge traditionally vaporizes all biological oils, moisture, and skin residue left behind on a cartridge casing. For decades, that heat left traditional latent print methods completely useless. But this month, researchers are utilizing a portable potentiostat to turn the fired metal casing itself into an electrode. By applying a mild electrical voltage, the device maps the microscopic salt corrosion etched into the brass by skin contact prior to the shot being fired. The forensic value here is incredible. It successfully bypasses the heat barrier, mapping level 3 ridge details on metal that was historically written off as completely unviable. And that brings us next to a massive calibration win from the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They just released reference material RM8043, which is specifically engineered for degraded DNA mixtures and complex biological substrates. RM8043 provides forensic labs with a standard sample containing controlled UV degraded DNA and multi-person mixtures to test and calibrate their equipment against. This assures that when trace messy mixtures are pulled from an active crime scene, the analytical interpretation is mathematically sound and court defensible. But even with a perfect calibration baseline, sometimes nature leaves you with absolutely no genetic material left to salvage when environmental exposure, extreme heat, or microbial activity leave a DNA sample too fractured to sequence. Proteins then act as the permanent ultra-stable biological backup of forensic science. The concept here is simple but powerful. Unlike fragile DNA, proteins are highly stable molecules that can withstand harsh environmental degradation for decades or even centuries, holding critical biological markers completely intact. To give you a rundown on how this works. In the daily lab, we already rely on mass spectrometry for routine clinical tasks like running drug screens. But in forensics, researchers utilize liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometry to identify biological sex and specific phenotypic traits from a hair shaft, a degraded blood stain, or a stray skin cell, where they can't generate a DNA profile. And we just hit a massive milestone for this technology. This technique is officially moving from an experimental curiosity into a courtroom-ready standard. The Organization of Scientific Area Committees has finalized OSAC 2026 S1008. Standard for sample processing in forensic proteomics to standardize these samples. But as incredible as this legal milestone is, working this tech on the active bench means facing a brutal dual front roadblock: volume and translation. Standard mass spec proteomics is a total resource hog. If you inject 10 billion protein molecules, the physical detection threshold might only capture a single million of them. Trace evidence generally just can't provide these kinds of numbers. Plus, due to the genetic code degeneracy, it's a strict one-way street. Biology cannot naturally read a folded protein and back translate it into the original DNA blueprint. But a massive breakthrough out of Stanford completely changes the game. They use synthetic chemistry to achieve single molecule reverse translation, essentially converting a physical protein chain directly back into a digital DNA library. The loop's incredibly elegant. The system uses a modified Edman degradation to clip off the amino acids one by one, instantly tagging each one with a specific synthetic DNA barcode. From there, antibody assays read the tags, generating a PCR amplifiable DNA reporter that logs exactly what the amino acid is and its precise position in the chain. And here's the ultimate payoff. Because that fragile protein sequence is rewritten into an ultra-stable DNA library, it completely bypasses the mass spec. We can process it directly on a standard high-throughput DNA sequencing platform. This through line completely redefines trace evidence collection. We're moving toward an era where we can amplify and sequence rare, microscopic protein strands from a tiny handful of cells. Once it's a DNA barcode, we can use standard PCR to copy it, completely shattering the historical dead ends of degraded evidence. If a perpetrator left behind even a single cell, the science can now amplify that record. But while it's cool to look at where the research bench is heading, we also have to deal with the casework hitting the news cycles right now. The reality on the ground, unfortunately, isn't just a straight line of positive breakthroughs. Long before we can routinely deploy tools like single molecule protein sequencing, we're still stuck auditing a justice system that relies on metrics that never should have passed a laboratory validation protocol to begin with. In keeping with Florida's previously mentioned history of photogrammetry and dog sense, we have to audit one of the most destructive entries on the junk science ledger: forensic odontology, specifically bite mark visual overlays. Let's look at the actual biology here. From a clinical perspective, human skin is a completely unacceptable substrate for recording technical metric data. Skin is highly elastic. It bruises unevenly, it tears, and it swells dynamically. Trying to match a rigid dental mold to a changing, healing, or degrading bite mark on human tissue is like trying to print a permanent, distinct stamp on a marshmallow and expecting it to hold a micrometric resolution. It's a biological impossibility. This completely unverified discipline is responsible for more than 35 documented wrongful convictions, including the infamous Robert Du Bois case right here in Florida, where a man spent nearly 4 decades in prison based on a bite mark match that was later completely obliterated by science. The forensic community has spent 2026 aggressively pivoting away from this visual guesswork, replacing it with trace saliva DNA testing and investigative genetic genealogy. To see how this catastrophic reliance on biological guesswork plays out in a real investigation, we have to look at a case that is dominating the true crime news cycle right now. The historical wreckage of this junk science is being completely exposed all over again as the public audits the infamous Sarah Saganitso murder case. This case was actually brought to my attention by one of our listeners, so huge shout out for dropping this onto my radar. I absolutely love when you guys send over data or cases you're tracking, so please keep them coming to my inbox. Even though this specific crime dates back to 1987, the sheer madness of the case against George Abney is making massive waves in current media. And it shows you exactly what happens when fake science takes the stand. The physical evidence in this case centered entirely on an orthodontic element, specifically a bite mark found on Sarah's body. During the trial, the prosecution brought in a forensic odontologist to serve as their specific anchor of science, and this expert stood before a jury and testified under oath that Abney's teeth were a definitive mathematical match for the marks found on the victim. And you can see why this case is trending again. The details coming out of the file are just mind-blowing. The expert claimed the bite marks were entirely unique to Abney, but bite mark analysis is notoriously completely subjective. It completely blows past every validation rule we have in a real lab. It's just guesswork disguised as biology. And let's be totally real about the history here. Just like the infamous Ted Bundy case, this prosecution match was based entirely on a loose visual overlay of dental mold superimposed onto photographs of bruising. Now, Ted Bundy absolutely deserved to be convicted of his crimes. But using his case to validate this methodology doesn't make the science any less bullshit. There's no mathematical metric for error, no statistical reference database, and absolutely zero biological confirmation. It gets even more bizarre, which is why the internet is talking about it right now. The defense team didn't just argue that the teeth weren't George's. They actually used the absolute imprecision and irregularity of the dental evidence to argue that the marks weren't even human. They suggested that the irregular patterns aligned with a ritualistic or animalistic attack, which fed perfectly into localized Navajo shapeshifter narrative. While this skinwalker defense is getting all the sensational viral headlines today, the reality is that the defense was simply using the erratic nature of junk science to support their theory. That is the scariest part of this entire story. It is why this case is still at the center for the fight for reform. When you let broken science through the door, the truth doesn't stand a chance. Like so many junk science cases, the bite mark evidence wasn't operating in a vacuum. It was used by investigators to artificially validate a confession that we now know was completely coerced through high-pressure interrogation and aggressive repressed memory coaching. The subjective teeth match acted as an unearned scientific stamp of approval on a completely fabricated narrative. However, because the physical evidence was nothing but a house of cards, this case is being heavily cited right now alongside other landmark bite mark failures like the Ray Krohn case. It is serving as a stark modern warning of how easily a junk science metric can be weaponized to lock a person away. And while the Abney case shows a system leaning into junk science to protect a narrative, a massive real-time breakthrough in Texas shows that what happens when persistent private data tracking forces a historical resolution. This takes us to the Texas Killing Fields, a desolate 25-acre patch of land off Calder Road in League City, Texas, where over 30 bodies or missing person cases have been logged since the 1970s. In September 1984, 16-year-old Laura Miller disappeared from a convenience store. Her remains were discovered 2 years later, in 1986, in that very field. In the 1980s, local law enforcement completely fumbled the opening hours of the investigation, treating Laura as a simple runaway. They failed to process the outdoor scene properly, ignored basic forensic protocols, and dropped critical pieces of physical evidence. Frustrated by decades of administrative stagnation and a historical lack of urgency from local agency, Laura's father, Tim Miller, dedicated his life to searching for the missing, eventually founding Texas EquiSearch in 2000. After decades of silence, a series of phone calls on the EquiSearch tip line started a massive domino effect. Tim Miller answered these calls himself. Over the last 4 years, he quietly and meticulously met dozens of times with a man named James Dolphs Elmore Jr. During these intense private meetings, Elmore cracked. He confessed to Miller that he had actively acted as an accomplice to the longtime primary suspect in the Killing Fields murders, Clyde Hedrick. Elmore spilled everything, detailing the exact, specific circumstances of Laura Miller's 1984 death and how her body was disposed of. The dominoes fell rapidly this past March. On March 21st, 2026, before a Galveston County grand jury could officially receive the indictment paperwork, 72-year-old Clyde Hedrick passed away at a Houston hospital while out on parole. Just days later, on March 31st, 2026, James Dallas Elmore Jr. was officially arrested and indicted by a Galveston County grand jury. The 61-year-old is currently being held in the Galveston County Jail without bail, charged with manslaughter for the death of Laura Miller and two felony counts of tampering with evidence and a human corpse regarding the historical murders of both Laura Miller and another Killing Fields victim, 30-year-old Audrey Cook. 40 years of a data dead zone, finally forced into the light because a father refused to stop tracking the truth. We would like to think that these cases are aberrations. When we look at the cutting-edge technology on our research benches, it's easy to feel optimistic about the future of forensic accuracy, but the true danger of our modern justice landscape lies at the intersection where human systems actively choose to outrun the data. We saw the ultimate terrifying proof of this just this month in Tennessee, where an institution chose to protect a 30-year-old courtroom narrative instead of looking at physical, biological reality. On May 21st, 2026, the state barreled straight toward the scheduled execution date for Tony Carruthers, a case I first started tracking because of Monty Matter's videos on social media, where she's been actively fighting for political change in Tennessee. To stop this clock, the ACLU filed an emergency motion with the Tennessee Supreme Court, begging for a basic forensic review of the evidence. There are specific, highly probative pieces of physical evidence from the original 1994 crime scene that the state has actively and aggressively refused to test, evaluate, or compare against alternative suspects. This isn't an issue of missing technology. This is a deliberate, systemic avoidance of possibly exonerating evidence. The state literally chose to rush an execution timeline while actively dodging a simple genetic and biometric comparison that could mathematically prove innocence or guilt. Let's lay out exactly what the state is actively hiding. First, the untested DNA. The ACLU's emergency motion demanded advanced DNA testing on the fabric ties used to bind the victims back in 1994. Initial trace testing from decades ago already found an unknown male DNA profile on these ties, a profile that completely excluded Tony Carruthers. The state has those ties sitting in an evidence locker right now, but they fought tooth and nail to keep it from hitting a testing bench before the execution clock ran out. Then you have the unmatched fingerprints. Technicians originally lifted six pristine latent fingerprints from the primary crime scene, including the doorknobs and the phone receiver believed to have been operated by the perpetrators. Not a single one of those prints matches Tony Carruthers. They have also sat unmatched in the system for 30 years, completely ignored by the prosecution. Carruthers' conviction was entirely narrative driven. There was no physical evidence linking him to the scene. Instead of examining the evidence in their storage lockers that likely would lead to another suspect, the state anchored their entire case on a single confidential informant who appears interchangeably in the legal files as Alfredo Shaw and Albert Shaw. Since 1996, the state has actively withheld information and lied on the record, falsely claiming Shaw was not a paid informant. Shaw himself later recanted his entire testimony, admitting under oath that it was completely fabricated. Yet the state spent decades burying this fact and refusing to let the unmatched fingerprints or the unknown DNA profiles disrupt their narrative. The reality of how this conviction was secured is deeply sickening. Carruthers suffers from severe, documented schizoaffective disorder and organic brain damage. Following a rapid series of defense attorney withdrawals, the trial court forced him to waive counsel and represent himself at his own capital trial while he was in a state of active, severe psychosis. By forcing him onto the courtroom floor in that condition, they guaranteed a catastrophe. His performance at trial was a disaster, essentially securing his own death sentence while suffering from delusions. The ultimate irony of this total failure becomes stark when you look at his co-defendant, James Montgomery. Because Carruthers was forced by the judge to represent himself while deeply psychotic, it completely infected the fairness of the entire proceeding. Montgomery was granted a brand new trial because of Carruthers' mental breakdown on the floor. As a result, Montgomery was allowed to plead out, resentenced to 27 years, and was released over a decade ago in 2015. Yet Carruthers remains on death row, facing lethal injection alone. This brings us back to Thursday morning, May 21st, 2026. The state repeatedly refused clemency, ignored the untested DNA, pushed past the unmatched fingerprints, and escorted a man with severe mental deficits into the execution chamber at Riverbend Maximum Security Institution. This is where the machinery of the state completely collapsed into outright barbarism. For over an hour, media witnesses sat in a dark room with the execution chamber blinds drawn, while an IV team desperately tried to establish venous access to complete the execution. According to legal counsel and medical logs filed immediately afterward, the execution team punctured Carruthers more than a dozen times across his arms, hands, and left foot. He was left wincing and groaning in deep pain on the execution table. When they continued to fail to establish the required backup IV line, they brought in a physician who hadn't placed a central venous line in a patient in over 10 years. That physician attempted to force a deep central line directly into Carruthers' shoulder area, missed completely, and then the execution was officially abandoned after nearly 90 minutes of physical and mental trauma to Carruthers. Following this unprecedented clinical disaster, Governor Bill Lee was forced to issue an immediate, temporary, one-year reprieve from execution. As a medical laboratory scientist, I have seen medical professionals struggle to put in lines, and I know how quickly an ER or a floor can turn into a bloodbath from a failed central placement under high stress. But when you look at what happened to Tony Carruthers, you're looking at a state-sanctioned torture forced upon a non-consenting patient with severe organic brain damage, all while the state actively hid the biological data that could clear him. This isn't just a legal debate anymore. It's an outright Eighth Amendment train wreck. This botched procedure, combined with the forced self-representation during active psychosis and the flat-out refusal to run standard DNA and fingerprint comparisons, makes this case prime for a landmark Supreme Court challenge on multiple constitutional merits. The state tried to outrun the evidence, and instead, they exposed the complete broken reality of their own system. We'll be kind of keeping an eye on this one. But the Carruthers situation is unfolding in real time right now. And with that temporary one-year reprieve officially in place, the legal and medical fallout is just beginning. We're keeping a close eye on Tennessee over the coming weeks to see how the state responds to this absolute disaster in the chamber and whether the courts will finally force them to face the biological data sitting in that evidence locker. In fact, the rapid pace of everything we've covered today, from the brand new Stanford peptide sequencing to the breaking developments in the Texas killing fields to this crisis in Tennessee, proves that forensic reality is still shifting under our feet right now. Because this landscape is moving so fast, we're keeping a permanent watch on these cases. This episode is a snapshot of an ongoing real-time evolution. I'm considering turning this into a recurring interval series on the podcast to help us keep tracking these advancements and breaking updates as they emerge. Moving forward, we are breaking down the core components of a broken system. The anatomy of false confessions, the frailty of eyewitness testimony, and the high-stakes legal battles determining who lives and dies on death row. We're going to examine the terrifying reality of coerced confessions, how a person can be systemically broken down until they confess to a crime they never committed. We'll break down the absolute fragility of eyewitness testimony, looking at how easily human memory can be corrupted and weaponized on the witness stand. We'll also be looking directly at the frontline legal battles being fought by the Innocence Project, analyzing the massive structural hurdles they face when trying to force courts to look at new exonerating data. And ultimately, we're going to confront the reality of the death penalty itself, examining what happens when a broken forensic process meets an irreversible sentence. So, if you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue learning along with me. If you found today's deep dive into current events and emerging technology fascinating, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider. Reviews help other science-minded true crime fans find the show, so I encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on these cases or any future topic you'd love to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me directly at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and join us in our next episode.